There is a fifth dimension, beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. It lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Do not attempt to adjust your podcast. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Dimensions, the Twilight Zone podcast. On tonight's episode, we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 20, titled Static. This episode was written by Charles Beaumont, based on a short story by O.C. Rich. It was directed by Buzz Kulik, produced by Buck Houghton. Music by Marius Constant. In the cast were Dean Jagger, Carmen Matthews, and Robert Emhart. Its original air date was March 10th of 1961, and you can watch this episode on Freevee TV, Tubi TV, Paramount Plus, or the excellent Blu-rays or DVDs. And as I always say, if you have a little extra money, buy the Blu-rays. They're well worth it. Even in today's realm of everything being digital, it's still nice to have that physical media. You know, it's never a bad idea, at least in my opinion. With that being said, fair warning, there are spoilers ahead, so if you haven't seen this episode since Major Bose was on the air, you know, or if you haven't seen this episode since, you know, say the Carter administration, pause this podcast and go watch this episode, come back, and resume the podcast. And as always, if you have any feedback or if you have anything you want to say, feel free to email me at dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. So with no more delay, let's get into the opening narration. No one ever saw one quite like that, because that's a very special sort of radio. In its day, circa 1935, its type was one of the most elegant consoles on the market. Now, with its fabric-covered speakers, its peculiar yellow dial, and its serrated knobs, it looks quaint and a little strange. Mr. Ed Lindsay is going to find out how strange very soon, when he tunes into the Twilight Zone. So, we have Mr. Cantankerous, old Ed Lindsay, living in a boarding house where he's lived for several years, two decades plus, who gets tired of sitting around and watching his housemates turn their brains into mush watching TV. So he decides to go down to the basement of the boarding house he lives in and resurrect his old radio that he used to have. So he goes down there, and that's when we see Rod Serling pop out with his opening narration. And this is one of my favorite ones, where we see Rod Serling in the background, just because of the way it was done. It was quite perfect for him to just pop out from the shadows of the basement and tell us about Mr. Ed Lindsay and this radio. So as luck would have it, a neighborhood child sees him struggling with it in the basement and decides to offer a hand and help him bring it up to his room. Now, Ed Lindsay hands him a quarter and tells him to go buy a switchblade, which kind of gives you a little insight into his character. And Ed starts fiddling with the radio with the knobs, and he comes across a tune that he hasn't heard in some time called "I'm Getting Sentimental Over You" by Tommy Dorsey. Now, Tommy Dorsey, for anyone under the age of 80, was a big band leader from back in the 30s and 40s, and his success continued into the 50s until his death in 1956. Now, he was born in 1905 and lived in 1956, which means he was 51 years old when he died, and he died due to sleeping pills. He began taking them to go to sleep, and after eating a very heavy meal, took a few sleeping pills and went to sleep, and he vomited in the night and aspirated upon his own vomit, and sadly died. He was only, as I said, 51. So in the episode, when Ed Lindsay says that Tommy Dorsey's dead too, he wasn't lying, and it wasn't that long ago. Tommy Dorsey passed away from when this episode was made. So there's a little a bonus bio for the podcast. Tommy Dorsey, born in 1905, died in 1956, about 5 years before this episode aired. And Tommy Dorsey's big song was "I'm Getting Sentimental Over You," which is what we hear Ed Lindsay listening to on the radio, live from the Aragon Ballroom. He was listening to Tommy Dorsey. Now, this stirs something in him, and he goes down to eat and begins humming the song at the table, which of course he gets reprimanded by the landlady. At least I perceive her to be the landlady. I'm pretty sure she is in the episode. If not, it's just another housemaid. But either way, they reprimand him for, or she reprimands him for humming that song at the table, to which the professor asks him, what was that melody you were humming? And he tells him it's Tommy Dorsey's "Getting Sentimental Over You." He heard it on the radio live from the Aragon Ballroom, to which one of the other housemates says, well, you couldn't have heard it live because Tommy Dorsey's dead. And Ed Lindsay goes, I know that. So he goes to try to prove it with the portable set that's in the kitchen. And of course he can't find the station, because this is the Twilight Zone. Over the next, what we perceive to be a few days, the housemates see less and less of Ed, because he's kind of been a little more secluded, but he's also seems like he's a little more peppy in his step. This, of course, all comes after he lambasts the other tenants of the boarding house for watching TV, turning their brains into mush, and basically roasting the entire TV as a whole, which it's one of my favorite bits, because you got Ed Lindsay basically roasting TV, and they actually put two fake ads on the TV. Instead of using like real commercials, they made actual fake ads for the TV, and Ed Lindsay kind of starts roasting them, but he's kind of muffled a little compared to the sound of the TV, so it seems like no one pays attention to him, and they just pay attention to the TV, and it's kind of interesting the way they do it. They more or less pay no mind to Ed, which, of course, helps in the idea that none of his housemates kind of sympathize with him or see things his way, because they're more quote-unquote modern. He's more sort of stuck in the past. He's looking in the rearview mirror while they're looking out the windshield. And not saying that's better or worse either way, but that's just the way it is. And the only one that kind of understands where he's coming from is another housemate named Vinny, who played by Carmen Matthews. She is his former fiance from 20 years prior, and they live in the same boarding house, and there's tension there, obviously, because they live in the same boarding house, and they were once, in fact, fiance, you know, and all that comes with it. So the professor and Vinny both get rather worried about Ed and the way he's been acting, because he hasn't been acting himself. They decide to take it upon themselves to get rid of the radio. But now, before they do that, we come to find out that the station that Ed has been listening to, WPDA, is actually not a radio station anymore and had been out of business for some 15 years. It's at this point that Vinny and the professor kind of feel that Ed's kind of gone around the bend a little bit, and they decide to help him by basically breaking and entering into his room and absconding, stealing his radio and giving it away. So technically, a crime was committed against Mr. Lindsay. But so he comes home, he goes to find his radio is gone. He asks Vinny and the professor what happened to it, and they told him they gave it to the junk man. He goes down to the junk man, tries to take it back. The junk man tells him he can't have it, he has to buy it, so Ed gives him money, approximately $10, to buy the radio back, which, with a quick inflation calculation, would be worth about $103 today. So Ed hands the man, we'll see, essentially of a $100 bill, grabs his radio, and takes it back to the boarding house, plugs it in, and starts to listen again. He is interrupted by Vinny, who they have a really awesome scene together where Vinny and Ed talk about how they used to be lovers and were engaged to be married, but Ed's mother got sick and they wound up having to put off the wedding and everything, and then their relationship just sort of fell apart, and they've been basically living as strangers for the past 20 years. And Vinny reminds him that it was about this time of the year that they were to be married, and "I'm Getting Sentimental Over You" was their song. And she said, "Haven't you noticed that every time about this year you kind of change and become a little more curt and a little more sour than you normally are? It's because of that." And she leaves. A little while later, Ed plays the radio. The song comes on again, and he yells for Vinny to come. And we see Ed turn around, and he's 20 years younger. And we see Vinny pop through the door, and she is as well. They embrace while the song plays, and they run out the door together. And then we get Rod's closing narration. "Around and around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows. All Ed Lindsay knows is that he desperately wanted a second chance, and he finally got it, through a strange and wonderful time machine called a radio, in the Twilight Zone." Now, I gotta say, this is one of my favorite episodes of the second season, and it's one that's, like a lot of them, have kind of grown on me over time of repeated viewing. And it always held some sort of special place with me just because of my love of old-time radio programs from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and some of the 60s. Even though radio by pretty much the 60s was starting to be phased out, at least in the way that it was used back in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s. Now, I know the host of the Twilight Zone podcast, Mr. Tom Elliott, said that he loves old-time radio programs as well, especially from America, since he is British. And he loves the old-time radio programs, but he loves the sci-fi ones like X-1 and Dimension X and Inner Sanctum and those kind of things. And while they're wonderful programs, certainly, he said he doesn't care for the comedy, like the sitcom sort of radio programs. And while I do love X-1 and Dimension X and all that, give me the Great Gildersleeve or Jack Benny as a radio program, as a comedy, and I'm a happy guy. They're wonderful programs, and I don't know why Tom hates the comedies, but I can understand it. It's, you know, not everybody is, people have different tastes. People certainly have different ideas of what's good and what isn't, and that's why all media is great, and then the fact that it's subjective, you know. Another man's one man's trash is another man's treasure, that sort of thing. But this place holds a special, this episode holds a special place in my heart simply because of my love of the old-time radio programs, which I got through my father. He used to listen to all the old-time radio programs. Growing up in Chicago, there used to be a radio program that would come on every night of the week, and on the weekends, afternoons, if I remember correctly, but it was Chuck Shaden's old-time radio program, and we would listen to it at night sometimes. When I was a real little child, my father had a job where he would have to wake up early, and so sometimes he would take me and put me to bed, and we would listen to radio programs for a little while before going to sleep. And so I learned a love of old-time radio programs from my parents, and it continues to this day. I still love them. But that is why this episode holds a little bit of a special place. Now, this was also another one of those episodes that was shot on videotape, and while in some episodes, like 22 or The Lateness of the Hour, the videotape difference in the quality of the video somewhat enhances the viewing experience of the person watching the episode, because especially in 22, it makes it a little more ethereal, a little more creepy, but you don't really notice it in this episode, which is kind of odd, but you don't really notice it, and it doesn't really add or detract anything from this episode. But we get the videotape nonetheless. It is a videotaped episode. It is one of the six from season two, and it is one of my favorites from season two. And so I put it in a little higher regard than some of the others, for sure. But it is a great episode. Dean Jagger does fantastic. Carmen Matthews does fantastic as well. Even character actor Robert Emhart does well. And we'll get into those three here in just a minute. But I really like this episode. I put it on the same plane as it's a great second tier, so to speak, if you were doing it in, say, four tiers. this would be a great second one. Is it my top five, top 10? No. Top 25? Maybe not. But definitely top 50, for sure. I think it was well done. I think it was perfectly handled, perfectly cast, as well as perfectly acted, perfectly directed. It's just that the subject matter is a little weird. It's kind of muddled in a way between, you know, it doesn't really have the ability to focus on the transitive properties of the radio along with the love story with Vinny. And so it kind of flops back and forth in a way. And then just at the end, just sort of ends. There's no real, idea of, well, how did the radio transport him back? That sort of thing. We never really get the true payoff that you could have had, or that does happen in other episodes of the series, which I would say is one of the only detractions of this episode, is that it just straight up, it's time to end the episode now, so they get together and they run out the door 20 years prior. If I had to name a downfall, that would be the downfall of this episode, that it's more or less just ends, and that's the end of it. But it was done fantastically, and I really do like it. So with that being said, let's move on to bios. Now, this episode was directed by Buzz Kulik, who directed 9 episodes total of The Twilight Zone, and at least in season 2, if you look at his resume, and if you want to listen to his bio, he directed season 2, episode 1, King 9 Will Not Return, and I talked about him in a little more at length then. But he was the guy that they used for some going back in time episodes, especially in season 2, pretty heavily, with King 9 Will Not Return, if you remember that one. A guy goes back in time to the plane crash that he wasn't on because he was too sick to fly. He also directed The Trouble with Templeton, about the actor that goes back in time and sees his wife. He directed, of course, this episode, and here in a few episodes we will see him direct 100 Yards Over the Rim, which, spoiler alert, if you don't want to hear this, skip ahead about 10 seconds, that also involves time travel. So he was kind of the go-to guy, at least in season 2, of time travel episodes. So 9 episodes total, Buzz Kulik directed, a lot of them having to do with time travel or entering different dimensions, I guess you could say, and all done very well. It seems like some directors had their little niches in The Twilight Zone. Buzz Kulik going back in time slash that sort of thing. Don Medford, if stuff had to be filmed at night, he was kind of the go-to guy, it seems. So it's kind of funny when you look at it, how they use different people, for their strengths. So certainly, Buzz Kulik had some strong, showings, and we'll see him again, like I said, come season 3 and season 4. He directs one of my favorite season 4 episodes, Jess Bell. So when we get there, you'll hear about that as well. So let's move on to the man who would be Ed Lindsay, played by Mr. Dean Jagger. Now, he was born in 1903 and passed away at the age of 87 in 1991. Now, he was a high school dropout before going back twice, getting his diploma and then attending Wabash College. He then got a job working as a school teacher, which is funny because he didn't like school at least 2 times before, and became interested in acting, where he enrolled at Chicago's Lyceum Art Conservatory. He has a distinction in his career of he appeared in both silent movies and talkies. His first movie was a silent movie in 1929's The Woman from Hell. And that movie also starred Mary Astor. And this was the road that led him to being a very well-known and very well-liked character actor. He did find success in 1949's 12 O'Clock High, where he won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. He also played in TV roles such as Twilight Zone, as well as Principal Albert Vane on the 1963-64 season of Mr. Novak. And he played in any kind of movies like war movies. He was also in 1971's Vanishing Point, which is kind of a popular movie for a certain crowd of people. He was also in episodes of The FBI, Fugitive, Alfred Hitchcock Hour, Bonanza, The Partridge Family, Columbo, Kung Fu, Alias Smith and Jones, Shaft, The Waltons, and Saint Elsewhere. His last acting credit was in the movie Evil Town in 1985. And as we said, he passed away in 1991 at the age of 87. So let's go on to the woman that would have been his fiancée slash was his fiancée slash wife at the end of the episode, who played Vinny, Carmen Matthews. Carmen Matthews was born in 1911 and passed away at the age of 84 in 1995, so not too long after Dean Jagger exited stage left, so did Carmen Matthews. She was a great character actress whose film credits include Butterfield 8 from 1960, A Rage to Live, 1965, Sounder in 1972, and Daniel in 1983. She also appeared in some made-for-TV movies and was also Colonel Lillian Rayborn on an episode of MASH in 1972. She was also a Broadway actor who took the stage alongside such talent as Don Ameche, Angela Lansbury, and Joanne Woodward. And her last on-screen appearance was in the 1990 film The Last Best Year with Mary Tyler Moore and Bernadette Peters. During her life, she also did some charity work. She actually, in 1975, set up and ran a residential summer camp for kids on her 100-acre farm in Connecticut. And a decade later, she set up an educational center there as well. So she was a good person and a good actress. And lastly but not leastly, the man who would be the professor, Mr. Robert Emhart, who was born in 1914 and passed away at the age of 80 in 1994. Now, Robert Emhart had 174 credits to his IMDb, so he was no slouch when it came to working, and started out with his first appearance in a 1939 movie titled Marco Millions. And his size and looks and manner of speaking mostly lent him to somewhat always being cast as villains or nefarious types, although this couldn't be further from his actual character. as a person, being a generous man, not at all like the characters he portrayed. While attending Butler University, he got into theater and then went to London, where he gained experience at the London Academy of Dramatic Arts in 1937. And while in England, he met his wife, actress Sylvia Sedelli. They would go on to have four children together. It was in England where he found himself understudying Sidney Greenstreet on an American tour of a play, while he was in the United States debuting on Broadway. In The Pirate, he went on to win the Critics' Choice Award, or Critics' Circle Award, I'm sorry, for Best Supporting Actor in Life with Mother. And he appeared in 11 other plays in New York until 1959, where he made the switch over to television. He was no slouch in movies either, appearing in movies such as 310 to Yuma, Underworld USA in 1961, and The Stone Killer in 1973 with Charles Bronson. His favorite and probably most recognized film role was as Shirley Knight's paunchy and gracious but ultimately insane father in the 1966 movie The Group. Now, while he was appearing on the big screen and the small screen, he also had time to act in 125 different summer stock productions during this time, during the time of his career. On top of being in television programs such as Have Gun Will Travel, The Untouchables, Perry Mason, Bonanza, six episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and had a recurring role on the soap opera Another World. So he's one of those people that you know you've seen him 100 times, you may not have known his name or may not remember what all you've seen him in, but you've seen him in a lot of things. And he was a really, really good actor. He was in one of my favorite Andy Griffith episodes, where he plays a businessman on his way to Raleigh when his car breaks down in Mayberry. And being a Sunday, of course, the fueling station isn't open to have work done, and Goober's out on his boat, so he can't fix the car, and Gomer doesn't know how to fix cars yet at this point, and this is before he goes into the Marines. And so this man winds up staying with Andy Taylor and Aunt Bea and all of them and having supper and everything else, and learns to kind of slow down a little. And the episode is Man in a Hurry. It's a great episode. If you like the Andy Griffith Show, a lot of people love that episode. So if you haven't seen it, go watch it. It's a great episode. So that'll do it for the bios of this episode. So let's move on to trivia. So, as I said before, this was the 5th of 6 Twilight Zone episodes to be videotaped. The last one will be coming up soon with Long Distance Call, starring Bill Mumy. The closing monologue ends with Tommy Dorsey's theme, I'm Getting Sentimental Over You, instead of the typical Twilight Zone theme music. The episode features a radio clip when Ed is listening to the radio of the Fred Allen Show. And if you don't know who Fred Allen is, that means you're probably under the age of 70, which is fine. But Fred Allen had a radio show, and the show was built around a place called Allen's Alley, where he would interact with various characters from the alley and interact with them and so on and so forth. One of the most famous characters also heard in the clip was Senator Cleghorn, played by Kenny Delmer, the blustering Southern politician who was the inspiration for Looney Tunes character Foghorn Leghorn. So there's that. Also, as an aside, they originally, Rod originally wanted to get a radio clip from the radio show The Fire Chief, which starred Ed Wynn, which, if you remember, Ed Wynn was in the season one episode One for the Angels, where he played Lou Bookman, who bartered with death to save the life of a small girl. That was his radio program, or he was on that radio program, and they tried to get a clip of that show, but weren't able to in time, so they had to go with Fred Allen's show. Now, the radio announcer on the radio was played by Bob Crane, and this was his first, technically first, TV appearance. Now, if you know who Bob Crane is, you know that he was Hogan in Hogan's Heroes, and he also had a very interesting life and died in an interesting way. I'm not going to get into that on this program, but if you wanted to learn more about that, you can read about it, or you can watch the movie Autofocus, starring Greg Kinnear, who is a great actor also, and it's actually a very good movie, talking about Bob Crane. Very interesting stuff, but this is Bob Crane's technically first television credit. Now, speaking of Ed Wynn, he actually gets mentioned in the episode by Vinny. And Ed Wynn, as we've discussed, was in two episodes of The Twilight Zone, one for the Angels, and in 90 Years Without Slumbering, which will be coming up in season 5. At one point, Ed's radio begins to play an address to the nation from President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This is the opening of one of FDR's famous fireside chats, a series of programs which he spoke directly to the American people over the airwaves, an innovative concept at the time. This particular fireside chat was from April 28th of 1935 and discussed the workers, or the Works Relief Program. This episode takes place in April of 1961 and 1940. The station Ed hears on the radio, WPDA, was fictitious. However, just 5 years later, in 1966, WPDA was licensed in Jeffersonville, New York. The station still broadcasted as of 2 years ago. Jerry Fuller, who plays the singer on TV, wrote the hit songs Young Girl and Traveling Man. According to the production slate included on the Blu-ray release, again, if you got the little bit extra scratch, buy the Blu-rays. Buy the Blu-rays. I wish I was making money off of them by, you know, of trying to get you to buy them, but I'm not. I wish I was. But they're just worth it. I don't care if I am or I'm not. But according to the production slate on the Blu-ray release, filming started on November 20th of 1960, so as most TV shows and movies, stuff is usually filmed up to a year prior its actual release. In the opening scene, one of the things that flashes across the screen of the TV is a commercial for chlorophyll cigarettes. This, of course, is a parody of the great chlorophyll craze of the early 50s, in which chlorophyll-laced toothpaste, mints, and even cigarettes were sold for their supposed odor-controlling properties. The Federal Trade Commission eventually cracked down on the exorbitant claims, and the fad died. Although the show was much criticized over the years for briefly moving from film to videotape, this particular episode did not suffer as much as the others because it required no exteriors or visual special effects. In essence, it's a 30-minute stage play, which is one reason why you kind of don't notice it as you do some of the other episodes. Especially in the episode with the used cars. You know, you can totally tell it's filmed on a soundstage and that sort of thing. You don't really have that here because it's all interior shots and all in basically two rooms. Being one of the videotaped episodes, all of the production happens live on the same soundstage, acoustic reverberations, audible on the boarding house television set, including announcements on Ed's radio set, tip off the audience that everything was recorded simultaneously within a few feet of each other. And you can notice it some if you pay attention. And with that, let's move on to the goofs of the episode, the mistakes. So, according to the calendar on Ed's bedroom wall, it's April of 1959, which, you know, doesn't track if we're trying to say this thing took place in 1961. So, of course, a little bit of a continuity error, I guess you could say. When Ed's changing the TV channel back to the cigarette ad, the picture changes a moment before he turns the knob. When Vinny and the professor leave Ed's room, the ceiling light in the background in the hallway is hanging extremely low, about even with the shoulders of the actors, which would make it impossible to walk under if that hallway was real. Ed puts the coin in the payphone and lifts the receiver. The entire wall holding the phone moves, of course, because it's built on a soundstage, made out of plywood, and it would be a little flimsier than an actual wall. And the boarding house television set sits on the fireplace mantle. However, this would be impossible because the mantle is only about 12 inches deep, and television sets of that time were decidedly wider and deeper than that, and so it wouldn't necessarily fit there unless you'd made a little hole in the wall to make it fit. And that will do it for the goofs of this episode. So let's get on to the likes and dislikes. Well, as I've already said, I like this episode. It's one of my favorite of the videotaped ones. It's kind of one of my favorite of season twos. It keeps growing on me. I don't know how else to describe it. It just keeps growing on me. It's a lot of sentimentality in this episode, and I'm a sucker for sentimentality. And it, on a personal note, it means a little something more to me than just a random episode of a TV show. But I really liked it. I liked the direction. I like the acting. And I like the fact that Charles Beaumont was a TV writer, and he kind of used this medium to bash the actual thing he was working for, i.e. writing for television. The original story by O.C. Rich, the idea was that the man was a unhappily married man who used the radio to escape into the past when he was single. It was originally based on a story by O.C. Rich titled Tune In Yesterday. He sold it, instead of selling it as a short story, he sold it to the Twilight Zone upon Charles Beaumont's request, or I guess his recommendation. They took it and ran with it, but they had Charles Beaumont rewrite the script. And Beaumont changed it up slightly to Ed being a bachelor and not have been married, and took the initiative to kind of lambast television, which he said, basically like in the TV show, was turning people's brains into oatmeal. And Charles Beaumont didn't really care for TV, even though it paid the bills, which, you don't have to like something even if it pays the bills. Those things don't have to be mutually exclusive. But I thought it was, I always thought it was funny that Charles Beaumont hated the very thing he worked for. And of course, in the likes department, my favorite line of the show is, radio is something that has to be believed to be seen. And if you are a fan of radio and love listening to especially the old-time radio programs, at least in my experience, I can sit or even be doing chores around the house or what have you and listen to an old-time program, radio program, and I can see the pictures in my head, and I can make up pictures of the interiors or where they're at or the people that are doing it or what things look like. And radio is something that has to be seen to be believed, or has to be believed to be seen, is one of the best lines ever, I think. So we have that. Now for the dislikes. Like I said, my main dislike of this episode is that we get no real, there's no real reason or thing of why it just all of a sudden was 1940 again. You know, there was nothing happened. There was no wavy lines, no weird music, no anything. He didn't walk through a door or anything like that. He was just in his room. Vinny runs in. They're both younger. They run away. It looks like they were just like, oh, wait, it's got to end, so let's end it now. And that is basically my only dislike of the show. So with that being said, let's move on to the casting. So for the role of Ed Lindsay, played by Dean Jagger, I would cast Michael Keaton in that role, because he has the ability to play just old, sarcastic, mean person. He can do it. And for the role of Vinny, I would go with Gina Davis. Why? Because I love Gina Davis. What's not to love about that woman? She's awesome. She's a great actress. I'd love to see her again. And for the professor, I would go with Jason Alexander. Just for fun. Just for funsies. So, if you like that, great. If you disagree with me or you think someone else would be better, write me, email me, dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. And lastly, let's talk about the moral or philosophy of the episode. Now, this is one of the true things of, you know, you can't go home again. It's kind of like Walking Distance or one of those episodes where someone tries to change things that happened in the past or relive the past or revisit the past, and it doesn't always work out the way you think. Except in this episode, it kind of does. And, you know, it's we never really, I mean, you kind of always get the idea that what happened happened, but you could also just sort of draw the conclusion also that Ed just went out of his mind and he was just imagining the whole thing of Vinny and him both being younger and it being 1940 again and they run away together. The episode could have ended with him thinking that, and then we see another shot of him sitting on his bed just listening to static on the radio with a weird smile on his face. It could have ended that way too. But the idea that you know, you never get a second chance to make a first impression, and you rarely, if ever, get a second chance at a crossroads in life. And I think this one is kind of a cautionary tale of that, even though it's kind of a happy ending, if you subscribe to that sort of idea that it actually happened. Or it's a cautionary tale if you can also picture Ed Lindsay sitting on his bed listening to a radio playing nothing but static and having lost his mind. So it can be a dangerous thing, trying to relive the past and looking backwards. And maybe that's what this episode is trying to tell us. I don't know. If you agree, let me know. If you don't agree, let me know. Write me either way. DimensionsTZPodcast@gmail.com. So let's bring this in for a soft landing with just a little bit of listener feedback by our good friend of the show, Scott, who writes in and says, hi, Bill. I'm out doing yard work and listening to the episode 22, one of my all-time favorite episodes. Easily top 10, he says. Oh, I agree. It's a great episode. Good taste. Good taste, Scott. I'm writing because I never realized this was one of the videotaped episodes. I remember this particular episode being in heavy rotation in Southern California on KTLA Channel 5, but the other episodes on tape I never really saw until many years later. Maybe on Sci-Fi Channel marathons, or where it was noted that it was one of the other rare episodes. And that's true. It seems like some of the, at least in the older days, the videotaped episodes didn't get a whole lot of rotation. I can agree with that. I didn't see any of the videotaped episodes, except 22, until years after I first started watching the show on reruns and whatnot when we lived in Chicago. He asks, do you have any insight as to why this taped episode seems to make regular rotations while few, if any, of the other tapes taped episodes did? And I don't. I don't have any insight into that. I wish I did. I sure wish I did. I don't. But I do know in the realm of the 6 videotaped episodes, 22, and in my personal opinion, Static, are the best of the two. Now, don't get me wrong, I love Lateness at the Hour. It's a great episode, but it's just not the same as 22 or Static to me. And I could be wrong, and maybe I am. If I am, write me, dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com, and let me know. And he goes on to say, and for my sake, what are the names of the taped episodes? Well, they are Lateness of the Hour, Night of the Meek, The Whole Truth, 22, Static, and Long Distance Call. Being as some of them are quite forgettable, it's definitely understandable that you wouldn't, that not all of them would be readily available in your memory. Especially The Whole Truth, at least in my mind, I usually forget that episode exists, much like Long Distance Call. I don't know why, I just don't like it that much, but we'll get into that one here shortly. And he finishes by saying, also, how could you leave us all hanging and not tell us your premonition story from the episode of last week's, titled, you know, 22, I discussed that, you know, everyone has somewhat of a premonition story, and I do as well. And Scott was wondering why I left you hanging. He finishes by saying, anyway, still loving your podcast. Keep up the good work. I love hearing your insights. Thank you, Scott. And I will now tell you, if you want to hear it, my premonition story. When I was a child growing up in Chicago, we had a family dog, a rather large family dog, who we also had a wagon. And we got the bright idea to hook the dog up to the wagon, and my brother would pull me around in the wagon with the dog, kind of like a horse in a cart. Bear in mind, I was about 5 or 6 at this point. We were walking around our block in the neighborhood, and I was riding in the wagon. All of a sudden, my brother stopped, and I don't know what, he got this look on his face, and the dog stopped as well, and I heard a voice in my head say, "Get out of the wagon. Get out of the wagon." And as fast as my little 6-year-old legs could carry me, I hopped out of the wagon. No sooner did my feet hit the ground than the dog took off like a shot. The dog ran about a block and a half. We chased him until we found him in one of our neighbor's yards. The only thing that stopped him from running after whatever he was running after, whether it was a cat or a rabbit, whatever it was, the only thing that stopped him was the wagon got wrapped around a tree and it stopped him. And had I not gotten out of the wagon, I would have been seriously injured or worse. So that was my premonition story. If you have one, write me. Tell me. DimensionsTZPodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. And with that, let's bring this episode in for a closing. And stay tuned for next week's episode, where Jed Clampett has telekinesis. So stay tuned, everyone. Thank you all for listening, and have a good night.